All right, hi, good evening. Thank you for coming out to this month's TA3M, Techno Activism Third Mondays. I'm really curious, how many of you in the audience are librarians? Ooh, so that's a good number here. Is this your first TA3M, librarians? Yes? Awesome. How many of you are regular TA3M attendees? And are most of you working in technology? Yeah. So my name is Audrey. I'm a librarian. Like most of our panelists, almost all of our panelists are librarians. This is my second TA3M, so I'm not sure how I found myself here, other than I really enjoyed the last one I went to on repealing the Patriot Act, and I think that was April. Yeah. And that happened. So that's good. We did a good job. And then I told Sandy I would love to get involved, and she said, oh, why don't you just host the next event? And I was like, oh, okay. So that's what's happening right now before your eyes. And I tried to dream up what I would like to see. Since I'm not super familiar with the history of this event, I would just love to see librarians thinking of themselves in the mode of a techno-activist. And I would love to see techno-activists thinking of themselves more like librarians. So with that in mind, I just want to have a really casual conversation here tonight. Hopefully, I would love to get the audience involved, whether it's questions at the end or if you want to jump in at any time and interject or have a point that you want to make, raise your hand and I'm happy to call on you. But let's go ahead and get started. I was just going to give you a quick... just a quick primer on libraries and privacy. Historically, libraries have been very strong on privacy. The American Library Association has affirmed a right to privacy since 1939 when they made their first code of ethics. The third principle is we protect each library user's right to privacy and confidentiality with respect to information sought or received and resources consulted, borrowed, acquired, or transmitted. And I think libraries see themselves as really essential to an informed democracy, devoted to ensuring information is available to everyone. But we're also at a moment in time where we get to reimagine what libraries are in the digital world. And I think in light of the Snowden revelations, many librarians, despite having a really strong historic record of standing up against the Patriot Act and having various resistance efforts against encroachment on privacy rights. I think once the Snowden revelations came to pass, a lot of librarians started wondering, are we really truly prepared and equipped to meet these privacy needs that are now overwhelming? And I think that's what we're all here to talk about. Are libraries actually alternatives to the surveillance culture? That's a question I would love to hear each one of you speak to. And if we are not fully able to guarantee the full promise of intellectual freedom in our libraries, how could we do that better? And how could we build partnerships with the people in the audience here tonight that would enable us to be more effective? So with that being said, I wanted to just start off with you, Melissa, and get you to give us a on-the-ground picture of your work at the Brooklyn Public Library. I'll introduce her first. Melissa Marone is a public librarian. She's an editor of Informed Agitation, Library and Information Skills, and Social Justice Movements and Beyond. And she has written a lot about libraries, technology, and privacy. So here you go.
Thank you. Hi. And I've written a lot, if you count, basically one article, or two articles. But I'm Melissa. I work at Brooklyn Public Library, where I've worked for many years, and now I work at the Central Library in one of the departments. And I'm just curious, for those of you who don't already work in libraries, how many people have used a public library in the last month or so?
Good.
And how many of you are associated with a university or otherwise using a school library? Okay, cool. So for the some of you, this will come as no surprise, but just speaking generally of public library use, it does still happen. Every so often you see an article about, you know, shouldn't we all just close all the libraries? And, well, I think definitely the nature of library use and public library use specifically is changing, that it's not all print reading that we do. You know, the footprint of collections may need less space, perhaps. People use public libraries, people of all ages. Studies show that public libraries are still seen as trusted institutions in, you know, a world where many institutions can't be trusted. So public libraries have a lot of goodwill among people who use them and people don't. Another thing to keep in mind is that many, many, many people still get their sole or a significant part of their computer use and internet accessibility at their public library. And so this is people who don't have any sort of computer and need to use public computing centers, such as at the library, which require only your library card to get on the computers. If you don't already have a card, we sell a guest pass for that day's use. But this also includes people who have internet access just through a mobile device. And so if you imagine a smartphone and how difficult it is to do many tasks on that little screen, you know, you can't really adequately update your resume and, you know, upload it to a potential employer's website. So a lot of people who have smartphones still use desktop computers at the public libraries. And some of our branches also lend out laptops, not to leave the building, but that's another option. So I just want to impress that public libraries are mediators of technology in many ways. And just as the library institution is trusted, library staff tends to be trusted. Something that we see a lot of is a wide range of tech savviness and also a wide range of attitudes towards surveillance and other aspects of technology. So on the one hand, we see people who literally will like leave their email account logged in. Maybe they'll minimize it, you know, mistakenly thinking that that's going to log them out, and then wander away from the public computer and, you know, without doing anything else. Some people want library staff to input their credit cards, in, not the library staff's credit cards, but their own credit cards into a website to purchase something. You know, some people are overly trusting. Other people are perhaps, you know, overemphasizing the potential risks of online use. So we see this wide range. One of the challenges that we have in the library is trying to help people in one-on-one interactions that may not lend themselves to, you know, a lengthy educational experience. So we do classes at Brooklyn Public Library. We've also hosted some crypto parties. And so we try to serve people, the many people who are new computer users, and also people who do have some experience, but, you know, don't necessarily know, you know, might not have heard of Tor or other ways to, you know, step up your ability to protect your online transactions. So we do public education. We offer the access to the technology in the first place. And something else to keep in mind about libraries, and again, I'm speaking of public libraries, but this goes for many other types of libraries. We'll hear about academic libraries. But libraries have, as Audrey said, had a long history of emphasis on the privacy and confidentiality of library use. So for many, many years, that meant your book borrowing records, that libraries would not give up those records, that libraries treated people's recreational reading use as an important expression of their desires, of their predilections, of their intellectual, you know, dreams. And that still happened. I mean, just today, somebody was sort of shyly asking for an interlibrary loan book about bisexuality and spirituality. And, you know, he was a visibly religious person by his head covering. So, you know, and just his demeanor, this is, it, you know, probably not something that he would want others close in his life to know that he was interested in reading. But I think that one thing that libraries need to do better is to consider our users' online transactions as worthy of as much protection as their book borrowing records. So on our public computers, when people are communicating with their loved ones overseas, when people are using social networking applications, and as you all probably know better than I do, you know, servers can be located over state lines, over country lines, so people's communications can cross through many regions that don't necessarily have the same coverage. And, you know, we are not looking at this online life of our patrons in the same way as we look at other transactions we have with them. And so I think, you know, we'll speak more during the conversation, but just to close, one of the things that our other speakers will talk about is a grant that we are working on for training the library staff better in digital privacy and literacy topics. So making sure everybody is up to speed on a lot of these issues and also the tools that can help with them, like I mentioned Tor, like PGP, like browser plugins. A lot of these aren't possible to be put on even the staff computers, which is one of the contradictions we experience in the library world. But this is something that we are emphasizing. And so when I think about why this is so important and why I think we need to talk about privacy among other data literacy issues in the library, it's not because I, you know, personally have a lot of technological impetus. Like I, you know, I'm not the sort of, I know what PGP is, sort of, but I am still too lazy and intimidated to try to use it. So it's not like I am drawn to the tools, but what I'm drawn to is the greater spirit of critical thinking that inspires among me as a library worker, and also what I would want our users to have, no matter how new they are to computers and to the internet. I think that this is all part of the critical thinking and the combating of the chilling effect of feeling like there's a surround of corporate and government surveillance around you. And so that's why I think that this is one area where library staff and technologists should be collaborating.
Beautiful. So I think that leads well into our next speaker, Alicia Selly. She's Associate Librarian for Collections at the Graduate Center Library at CUNY. And she speaks and writes on issues of digital rights restrictions, particularly in electronic texts. And she gives some great speeches on DRM and third-party platforms. But something that, you know, you can talk about whatever you want to talk about, but I guess my frame for your question would be, I'm interested in, I think you are taking the steps to be an activist librarian in your career, and how's that going? And what are these challenges that you're running into, and where do you see the boundaries of the institution coming back against you, trying to stand up for the values of the library that you believe in?
Thanks, Audrey. Thinking about libraries and privacy is a really, there's many, many places that we all could go. I think we could have, you know, we could talk about this every week for a few years and still have things to talk about. So I have just a couple of instances, thoughts I want to ruminate about from my perch as an academic librarian who is now somehow in charge of buying things. And I'll talk a little bit about that and how also I see us buying things can be a danger in terms of privacy. A recent collaboration that I experienced was, I went to this Warrant Canary workshop conference, all day session that a friend who's here had invited me to, and there were a lot of lawyers and technologists in the room talking about whether to use warrant canaries in response to gag orders and NSA inquiries. And all of these folks really wanted to hear from librarians because of the work that librarians have been doing against the Patriot Act. And I felt very conflicted being in that room because on the one hand, I feel like we have all these wonderful professional ethics and we have a history of standing up for patron privacy, privacy in general. But then I think about what happens every day in my library and how much of our metadata is out on third-party servers and is in no way being controlled or sitting behind out things that we control, we're really giving over our power to protect patron privacy when all of the searches are done in databases that are basically mining all of those searches in order to sell us more things. So I'm really critical of corporate control of libraries. I don't think there's enough work being done to think about that more critically in libraries, outside libraries, et cetera. So it's really wonderful to be involved in conversations like that, but I think it's just impossible. It used to happen, I think, more in print when you think about, like, maybe we had control of our catalog and when it was a physical card, but now that everything is on a third-party server, we are giving everything away and we have... Really, we don't have a leg to stand on in a larger technological conversation, so let's discuss that. The second thing that I wanted to talk about was my own work against restrictions in ebooks. So since 2009, I've been collaborating with technologists to try to convince my colleagues not to buy ebooks with DRM, essentially. And there have been some really lovely things that have come away from this work, and there have been some really difficult things that have happened in trying to actually take a stand and say, like, this is the line that I'm drawing and we need to be over here, not over there. We talk also about, like, organized librarianship and hierarchy, but there's a lot that comes with thinking about neutrality and librarianship and privacy and whether librarianship is inherently political or not, so let's talk more about that. But I've been using DRM kind of as a lens to see how much we are interested in privacy and technology and to try and have more conversations that are with librarians but also outside of libraries and trying to protect the right to read and the right to read without being surveilled because ebooks in general just provide a way in which to trace so much more, like each page, how long it was viewed, what we've highlighted, those sorts of things that print books that were circulating among multiple people just didn't allow that sort of tracking and tracing. And so that's, I think we should be thinking more about that. And then the third thing I wanted to talk about kind of echoes what Melissa was saying about public libraries, just in that in academic libraries as well, people don't have control over their own machines when they use the machines that we provide to them. And I work at CUNY, and not many of our students have their own machines otherwise. So we're not teaching people to be liberatory in their thinking about computers when we're really giving them, like, machines that have been restricted. And there's really great work too that colleagues have been doing, studying CUNY students specifically, the undergraduate scholarly habits ethnographic project that some of my colleagues have been doing is really wonderful in terms of what technology students are actually using. Many people are writing papers on their phones when they don't have computers, those sorts of things, just understanding, like, what's actually happening. I highly suggest I can, like, send out the link somehow, taking a look at that to see what's actually happening on the ground in this city with technology.
Thank you for giving us a reality check.
And Sita, I guess I would invite you to give us a further reality check on where we stand. And could you talk a little bit about the unequal effects of surveillance in that you've uncovered in your research? Sita is a senior research fellow at the New America Foundation, and her work focuses on digital equity, security, and privacy. She's exploring how data profiling and discrimination experienced by historically marginalized groups, and she's interested in examining different models for detecting and responding to data-driven discrimination. So, yeah, feel free to connect it to libraries and how that confluence is compounding all of these issues.
So, good evening, everyone. I am the non-librarian on the panel.
Honorary.
So, for the past 4 years now, I have had the fortune of working with a number of community-based organizations, social service organizations, as well as Brooklyn Public Library, doing research at the intersection of digital inclusion and privacy, surveillance, and data profiling. And the motivation comes from, so let me just say really quickly, one of the things that I observe in working with libraries is that there is a lot of goodwill and an amazing amount of history that connects the library institution to privacy and protecting privacy, but as Melissa was pointing out, the days in which we can be concerned about this relatively constrained information flow from the patron to the library institution, which may be intercepted by the government. That kind of equation is no longer the case, right? We have a, as Alicia was saying, we have a vastly more complex information ecology that puts the library in a position of not just providing internet access and access to knowledge, but a relationship, often a dependent relationship on third-party providers, that really brings into question the extent to which privacy protections and security protections are built into those services that would prevent, for example, patron data profiles from leaking into the greater ether or from different kinds of first-party and third parties from then developing data profiles, targeting, tracking, and so on and so forth. So, I've been struck in my research by what Melissa was kind of setting up, which is that there is a very, there's a population of patrons that come to the library knowing that this is a trusted institution. Trust is like a major currency of the public library, and I would imagine also of other academic libraries and private libraries. There's just too long of a history to get rid of that sense of trust. But we really need to question, and I really think that we could benefit from a conversation with the technologists in the room to really understand and accurately assess what is happening in these institutions. So to respond to the question, I would say the willpower is there, but institutional change takes a very, very long time. The fact that there are certain kinds of vendors that libraries have to depend on, and there are few alternatives, or that there's a long kind of, we might represent more of a minority than a majority. I don't know, that's something to debate as well, but. I think when you're dealing with sort of the professional environment and the professional culture, it is much more difficult to actually influence or see through the fact that, okay, well, maybe we should choose certain kinds of software and make a commitment to privacy and security at that level. Or maybe we should, ensure that each time we're teaching a digital literacy class that we have to incorporate some degree of end-user education to ensure that people really have a reasonable expectation as to what's going to happen with their data as they're using computers for the first time. So, gosh, I feel like I'm rambling a little bit, but that's a really important thing to hold on to, because what I've seen in libraries and in community-based and social service organizations is that there's so much excitement. So in the United States, there's something like still, I think, 30% of the population does not have access to broadband in the home. Broadband access and adoption is touted as this like wonderful thing that everybody needs to have in order to participate fully in society. Well, now that, I mean, we've known, if you're poor and a person of color, you've known that you've been surveilled in many different contexts over generations. However, punctuated by the revelations of Edward Snowden, we now know that it's increasingly difficult to like feel secure, feel like you're not tracked, like you're not watched. And you know, as people are getting this discourse, as many marginalized members of marginalized communities are receiving this discourse that you have to go online to learn how to be part of society, and everything you do from, you know, filling out your public benefits to sending your kids to school, all sorts of daily routines depend on digital interactions. I feel like we have a responsibility to actually ensure it, and also not burden individuals into thinking that they are alone in trying to protect their privacy and security and avoid being data profiled. I see that, you know, I've seen that, I think some of the most powerful stories are actually ones that came out of the library context, where people come in and, you know, they want to build their resume, they want to create a resume, they have to apply to a job, and they need to turn something around quickly. And what do you do? Well, you search online, and one of the first things that comes up is a quote-unquote free resume builder, right? Where you start to enter all of your personal information, and then what happened with the last screen? Well, actually, the service is not free. And in order to get your data into the format of a resume, you have to pay, right? And this is actually a story that came out in the context of the library. So what does that mean? That means that, you know, there are plenty of services and plenty of practices out there that really premise themselves on the collection, the quite insidious and seemingly harmless collection of data about individuals that are really in need. Now, that happens to all kinds of patrons, but I think the ability to protect and kind of undo some of the harms or wrongs that happen as a result of that are much more challenging if you are on a low income, if you have very little social support, if, you know, coming to the library is, you know, evidence of the fact that you don't really have the social network that can assist you as you navigate yourself through this complicated world. Okay, so I think that's enough. And I look forward to your questions.
Okay, I guess I'm putting a lot on you here. Our final speaker tonight is Bonnie Tijerina. She's a librarian, entrepreneur, library community convener. She's a fellow at Data and Society Institute, and she's working on thinking about the library's role in supporting data literacy, data privacy literacy, and ethics in big data research. So she's really working on all of the problems that we just listed out for you. And I would love for you to tell us a little bit about, you know, how you are envisioning librarians and libraries as vehicles for this new kind of data literacy education and this like desperately needed solutions to this, you know, ever increasingly complex problem. And if, I know you have some projects that you're working on that I would love to hear about, and I think you will give an invitation for feedback and collaboration.
Absolutely. Hello, everyone. Thanks for coming out. It's funny, when I got my library degree about 12 years ago, I had no idea being a librarian would be so cool. I don't know if any of you have seen recently any of the recent articles or stories on in NPR, recent interviews that had something to do with libraries or librarians being involved. Have any of you seen any of that? It's The Atlantic.
The Nation.
Just on the media last week. WBUR had a story. So so again, it's such an exciting time. And I actually left libraries about a year ago to be a fellow at Data and Society, specifically because I see a really important role for librarians in really the future of how we live and how we want to be in society. So Data and Society, for those who don't know, is a think tank created by Dana Boyd that is focused on sort of thinking about the social, cultural, and ethical impact of living in a data-centric networked world that we live in now. And so I wanted to kind of talk about a few projects. So there's been a lot of really good setup, and I came from academic library world, but I currently work on a project with Sita and Melissa that is kind of more public library focused, and I'm working on another project with Dana that's more academic library focused in terms of how librarians can support a whole new set of ethical issues that folks working in big data research are having to navigate now. So I think there's a lot of really interesting roles for librarians. So, also, I think librarians are playing a bigger, or sort of funders and other organizations are seeing the role librarians can play. I just wanted to name a few projects that have recently been funded that are sort of in the same space of privacy and surveillance. So the Knight Foundation has funded a few projects. The Library Freedom Project, which is a project that teaches librarians about privacy rights, law, and tech tools. To protect patrons from dragnet surveillance. We could talk a little bit about that, but you can get more at Library Freedom Project at their website. The San Jose Public Library was also funded by Knight to prototype essentially some games, games for all ages, for kind of creating more informed citizenry around their online activity and for their privacy. So we'll see more about that soon. And then the project that Melissa mentioned that Sita and Melissa and I are working on is funded by the Institute of Library Museum Studies, and that's this digital privacy and data literacy project. And it's a two-year project where we are looking to in the end, essentially train 600 or more library professionals and frontline library staff to have a better understanding of sort of how information flows and where kind of there may be privacy intrusions and data profiling, and how we in the library world might be able to help our communities sort of navigate some of that and empower them to be able to make the decisions so that they're aware of how their privacy, whether they have privacy or not, and kind of how they can be empowered to make the decisions about whether they want to participate and in what capacity. My part of that project, and this might be kind of where some folks might have some interest, is I was sort of tacked on after they've been working for a long time together, and I kind of showed up in New York about a year ago and to be at Data and Society. And my interest was to think about how we can create sort of an online tool to take and harness all this amazing work that Brooklyn Public Library and Sita are going to do over the next year and a half, and then work with Metro, that is a New York Library Council organization that helps provide professional development broadly through to librarians in the New York area. And so I wanted to create kind of an online resource to harness a lot of that and make it available to the folks who are in New York and then to librarians beyond New York. And I think initially we were thinking this could just be sort of a web resource with videos for some of the classes that are being put together. But I'd really like to think about how it can be more than that, how we can get librarians and library staff who are frontline in their communities all over the United States to be able to help them in some way, whether it's around sort of helping them navigate the sort of data privacy protection software or technology. So to kind of go beyond just a one-time or a couple-time training, and actually how we make this something that can be sort of ongoing and to kind of be a support network for librarians going forward. So we'd love any help and any ideas about that. there's a couple other things I could talk about, but I would also like to hear what questions you have, because I think we've presented a lot of different perspectives.
Yeah, so I'm going to open up the floor to questions. And just, yeah, libraries are, I would love to have this room walking away seeing like this as an opportunity, that libraries are truly unique institutions in our society. They're not many institutions that purely stand for the public good and actually believe in intellectual freedom and the right to speak freely, the right to organize, the right to challenge power. All of these things are actually what is, are at stake, as many of you who come to these TA3M meetings are very familiar. So I would like you to see libraries as the perfect partners for you, but we need help, and we would. I would also love to think about how could we, you could help us really actualize and bring to life the values and ethics that our institutions stand for, because I think that they're worth saving. And with that, is there any questions that from the audience?
You can just stand up if you want.
I was just wondering.
You can just speak up so I can pick you up on
the
mic.
Or maybe you can repeat. You can repeat the question after she says it.
Yeah, I'll repeat the question.
I was just wondering if you could speak more about some of the action you're taking so that libraries aren't tracking your data, or what success you have had, what walls you've come up against, if there is any sort of action against corporate infringement of that.
Yes, so just to repeat her question, she's curious about what actions have been taken and are being taken right now to address some of these privacy concerns.
I think that's a really crucial question right now. I think it's a question that we're only beginning to ask and needs to be investigated more, and I think should be part of any sort of educational campaign for librarians, like, where is the server for all of the things that we buy? What does that server do? Like, what is being collected? What's not? I think librarians are people, right? So many of us have lots of different skill levels in terms of what we know about the internet, the computer, etc. So folks might be purchasing things. Like, I just gave a talk, like a 10-minute lightning talk against DRM and to a room of librarians. And the only question that I got afterwards was, which vendors don't have DRM? So there's sort of these like desires to just purchase away the problem and not really think about the underlying structural issues at play. Just sort of to be like, oh, these are the good guys and these are the bad guys, and once we don't buy those things, we'll be fine.
I'm not gonna give you a specific example, but I think in terms of skill levels, they're all over the place, and I think a lot's happening at individual libraries versus, say, something happening across libraries more broadly. So there's, in terms of broadly, there's these projects where I think training is happening around the country just to kind of raise this issue, but there's another project that's happening that is about actually librarians, their vendors, publishers, and other kind of system providers for libraries getting together and talking at a very high level about principles, because in some ways, and part of why I took my fellowship was because we needed to have these conversations and we weren't having them yet. So we say we support privacy, it's much easier in the print world. Now we're in this new world, what does that actually mean? Like, what does that really mean? And so in some ways we're kind of starting from scratch. So we're starting with creating these high level principles. What does it mean? What does privacy mean in libraries? And then from there, kind of hitting some reasonable actions. And that's what we're doing kind of at the broad level. But again, I think individual librarians, depending on the interest and the skill level of the technologists in that individual library, it's really all over the place.
Yeah, and I would sort of complicate what Audrey was saying, the very positive things that Audrey was saying earlier, because I think it is not a terrific situation, and where I work, because it's such a large organization, you know, the scale we're at, we're almost a completely Microsoft house. You know, we have a large IT department that does really hard work, but because everything has to be so locked down, because, you know, as positive, you know, like, I can try to be sunny about human nature because I love working in a public library, but people do messed up stuff all the time, and, you know, so it's a reality that our IT staff has to deal with, that you can't download software on the computers, you can't install browser plugins, and, you know, just the because of all of the because of the fact that we don't build things in-house, which isn't to say that no libraries do, but because we really don't, we are beholden to all these third-party vendors. You know, we wanted to get on the public-facing catalog, we wanted to have this the layer on top that had some social features. You can rate books, you can post reviews, and the product is Canadian, number one, so privacy and other policies are different, you know, in Canadian jurisdictions than they are here in the U.S., but users have to, just to renew your books, unless you know how to get into the old version of the catalog, which is linked to but kind of hidden, you need to go through another, you know, agreeing to a terms of use for this product and create a username for it just to be able to get into your account. And so when we help people at the desk, like, the screen pops up, and because you want to focus on the task at hand and just be like, okay, just click agree, but then, you know, you also don't want to do that. So there's a lot of contradictions. I mean, one thing that happened recently at my library is, you know, we got this grant and our executive director was very excited about it, and she, you know, was quoted in the press release about this wonderful grant, and then we just had this, some kind of weird Department of Homeland Security event hosted at our library, you know, and she was also photographed. My colleague is like nodding vigorously. But so there's all these contradictions, and so I think that it is, like Alicia said, like, now we're really starting to ask, and we can't rest on these laurels of, like, libraries, you know, care about your privacy and you trust us and we're wonderful. I mean, I think libraries are wonderful, but, you know, there's a lot of work to be done now in particular. So that doesn't really answer your question.
Any other questions?
I guess I just have a follow-up question to that, kind of addressing the flip side of that. I mean, so I work at a women's health research organization in the communications department. Part of my job is understanding our users and our audience and what materials and periodicals and things like that they're interested in, to try to, you know, give a heads up to our editorial department or figure out how we position things on our website. So there's a lot of positive things about, if you want to call it, surveillance, but user data, certainly, and we use Google Analytics. I go to a lot of nonprofit, you know, tech conferences and whatnot, and the very simple fact of right now, if they switch on audience analytics, where they'll start tracking users more by the way they're looking at their computer, we'd have to update our privacy policy, but that would give me very detailed demographic characteristics of our user base, which is amazing for me. On the one side, I'm like, wow, this is great, yeah, guys, let's do it, yeah, let's talk to our management team, this will be fantastic. On the other side, it's like, this is terrible. Like, we don't want the responsibility of managing data. We don't want to burden our users by agreeing to something that they're being surveilled. I work in reproductive health and justice. It's a lot of very sensitive issues. I don't necessarily want people being tracked across the internet and identified with those issues if they feel that it's private to them. So for libraries, is that a conversation you guys have? Because on the one hand, I feel there's a mandate. Well, what are people searching for? What things should we be investing in? What books do they like? Not like, but on the other hand, all of the things that you just mentioned about user privacy, those seem to be very much in conflict, and I wish there was more conversation about that in nonprofits, so I'm just curious if you guys have the same thing in library world.
I'll just answer quickly because I have a microphone in my hand. As the mom, I think there's like this weird contagion that's happened within the civil society nonprofit community where it's like, oh my God, we need the data. Like, we need all this, like, user data, blah, 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 blah. Okay, that's cool in certain contexts, but in other contexts, it doesn't actually make good sense to collect that data. You can actually get that data using other means or other methodologies, right? It's quite powerful to have narrative, for example, demonstrating how accessing the library really improved somebody's life in a material and emotional way, right? Like, I was able to get a job because I attended a class, or I was able to pass my citizenship test because I attended a class at the library. Like, that stuff is powerful. You don't necessarily need the granular type of data that's suggested by big data analytics.
Well, so to answer your question in one word, I'd say yes. The profession is absolutely talking about, discussing, and debating where that line is. And in some of those discussions, I don't know where, I think that it's still just sort of up in the air, but one way that someone had suggested thinking about the use of data for services versus the privacy of patron is to actually look at and map what information we collect about patrons or about, say, checkouts or people who walk through the door, meaning, you know, gate counts and that kind of stuff, and put into categories what is patron data and what is library data. And as a way to sort of say, what is, like, in an aggregate are we saying we want to collect about our users, and how is that different from personally identifiable information or information that is about the checkouts or about the use of the material. So it's almost like, I don't think the profession's ever really done this before, but we're like parsing what we consider to be information that we collect. So it's just one kind of conversation we're having about that.
Just some comments in response. A lot of library systems, that data is parsed between patrons and circulation history, and a lot of libraries have decoupled that information. And I think we need to start addressing local things we could control versus the more abstract. For example, we could control our circulation systems potentially, and a lot of the searching that goes on our local interfaces and our websites through encryption and certificates. And then there's the more complicated, if you're part of a larger institution with an IT department, they can still packet sniff, and that's very abstract. You know, the library may have certain safety precautions, but nevertheless, a lot of things are going on beyond the library's control, and so data could be intercepted by who knows. I guess a lot of the focus of this conversation has been on vendors collecting data and data profiling, but I feel like a lot of folks voluntarily give up their data in terms of all the narcissism that goes on online with things with, like, Facebook and things like that. I'm more concerned with the invisible intercepts when encryption isn't occurring, or the fact that who knows what these encryption companies really are, like DigiCert. You know, who knows who's really holding the keys. So I think we have to be very cognizant of how we have to be cognizant and teach our populations on how we interact with data.
I saw some smiles and giggling and poor snickering over here.
Yeah, you had so many awesome points. And I think just a general, like, disassociation of users from data seems like a possible solution, like anonymizing traffic, using, like, tools like Tor, you know, like, bouncing off of various proxy servers, and also, like, finding a way to, like, maybe assign users, like, a serialized ID key for the different services they use that can then be like encrypted somewhere in a way that like the library has no access to that, you know, to the linkage between the data and the user. And to try to implement those solutions sort of very, very carefully, and to not abstract these concepts and to say, okay, like for this service and this vendor, what's a way that we could obscure the data, or a tool we could use to route around their like equal collection of data? Or like from the vendor's perspective also, like they're trying to impress their boss and come up with a cool idea of how to collect more data and keep that as anonymous as possible. Seems almost like a benefit for vendors that cater to libraries. Like, we can provide all this amazing detailed user data on people whose names will never be associated with the data. But just like everything, it's like, I think it's like a lot of collaborating between librarians and technologists on a case-by-case, very annoyingly, you know, like customized environments for all that stuff, for all of those services that we use.
So I wanted to thank you all for work that you're doing, because I think it's super critical, and it's great to have the libraries as a staunch ally in the fight for privacy in our culture. And I was just trying to think about what are the ways that we can actually maybe have some larger systemic positive changes. And so some of the ideas that you just proposed and other folks have proposed. So I do research on data privacy, and I've read a bunch of stuff, and actually separating users from their profiles or from the things that they do, just not counting like the personally identifiable social security number maybe from the data, is actually not particularly effective at protecting patron privacy. Because it turns out that when you collect lots of complicated detailed bits, there's ways that you can put those bits back together to produce a profile that's useful, even if you haven't got a link directly to personally identifiable information. So that's a step that needs to be taken for sure, but I don't think it's enough. So I'm wondering if you think that there are ways that libraries can push back to vendors or to other information systems or IT staff and say, what we really want is a system that provides these technical guarantees that you not only don't collect this extra data, like not just we're not going to pay you extra because you can give us shiny profiles with graphs of all of our users and detailed search histories and whatnot, but is there a way that the libraries can say to the vendors, actually, we're going to pay you, we're willing to even maybe prefer you over another vendor if you can prove technically that you cannot collect this information? So, for example, pushing copies of the databases that patrons search to the local library so that the searches happen within the library. Do you see ways that you can provide that kind of incentives to shift some of the defaults in the space?
I think those are really, that would be ideal. I think the lay of the land is such that not every library has a really lovely IT department that would be able to support that. So that's, you know, that's the reality that hits me first. But I think there's ever more collaborations between those two areas in academic libraries, I would say. And I think that is like the way that things need to start going. And I think, you know, like DIY and using our own servers and those sorts of things would really help. I also think, yeah, there needs to be, you know, we have, so for like collecting statistics of, you know, what things are downloaded and when, there are professional standards that everyone agrees to, and people will say, oh, I want to buy this thing. Do you use Counter? Can I know that you're counting in the same way, X, Y, and Z, and that's a selling point for vendors. So we could create some sort of a system where we say, hey, if you do data dumps or whatever, you know, you can use that as a selling point, and we want to purchase things that you know, work in those ways. Acquisitions in libraries, like changing things that happen there, seems like a very slow-moving process to me. That's my perception.
I'm a little more optimistic. Now this is twice, but I feel a little more optimistic than Alicia. So I've also worked in similar areas where I've When I worked in libraries, I worked with electronic resources and negotiating business terms and legal terms for how libraries can use resources. What I noticed is within the profession, if there is a topic that can get enough energy behind it and we make it as simple as possible in terms of, like, if we say, librarians, get behind this topic, and here is the phrase for you to go back to your vendors and say, tell them you want this, or tell them you want this paragraph included in our license agreements. I've noticed, from where I stand, that pushback has actually made changes. So it's getting us to the point, and I feel like we're just at the beginning of kind of getting around what we want from vendors in terms of, like, more specifics. That might be a year or so down the road, but I have faith in the profession that once we agree this is what we want, that we'll all kind of push that in that direction.
That's a great question. Two things. One is, in response to that, I've had this discussion with some technologists in the resource community before, and one of the things that I've wondered, or that this person was suggesting, was kind of having a repository of model contracts where such kinds of leverage has worked before. And so I'd ask of the technologists in the room that are, you know, dealing with other sectors of the economy, like health, education, et cetera, like, what model contracts have worked before in order to kind of, like, play one vendor off of another. So that's one comment. Second is to come back to Bonnie's discussion, which is, you know, there, I think, in the proposal that that Bonnie was talking about, where librarians and technologists are kind of matchmaking, like a dating service, right? Not quite, okay, I know you don't want me to talk about it in terms of a dating service, but, like, there are lots of situations where staff members have questions that they don't necessarily know how to answer, and they don't have the support within their own institution to answer those questions. So if there's a way in which collectivizing some of the concerns can happen, and that's one of the goals, I think, of this kind of, like, peer-to-peer, sort of radical reference-inspired type of technologist librarian dating service, you know, I think that you can begin to organize that knowledge in a way that really takes advantage of the power of collective bargaining or collective leveraging.
Yeah, so I'm Eric Hellman, but one thing that I've started to talk to people in the library world about is, just so you know how far libraries have come or how far they haven't come, is very few libraries deliver their websites using HTTPS or SSL. And it's the sort of thing that, like, the White House is now has put out a decree that all of their services will be over SSL. And so we're talking about how to make sure that all of the libraries jump on that bandwagon and get their vendors to jump on that bandwagon and get all the publishers who want to sell stuff digitally to libraries to jump on the bandwagon as well. And, you know, the barriers are mostly people not understanding how information leaks out of normal internet use. I've gone around to a few libraries and sort of looked at what their websites are doing, and I show them, for example, that when someone searches on a particular book, what to expect when you're expecting, that the web page makes a request of a cover image from Amazon with the refer header, so that Amazon knows that this particular person, identified by a particular cookie, might be interested in pregnancy books. And the libraries that I've talked to about this are just aghast that that's happening. And I think that's encouraging, because once people learn about what's going on, things are going to get better. And so I share Bonnie's optimism, but at the same time, we're sort of in a primitive place.
I'll take it for a second. As someone who has tried to convert SIPO to be to compel HTTPS on everything, it's going to break a lot of your site, I guarantee it, you know, because everything that's just like this Amazon link, where you've brought in an image or you've brought in a link from anywhere else that doesn't have it, is not going to work. So it's not an easy thing to do.
Sorry.
Just to say something about HTTPS, I mean, one of the many contradictions that we have, too, is that, so Bonnie was describing the Library Freedom Project, so this librarian, Allison Nacrina, who was mentioned in the recent Nation article, you might have seen her name. So she was working in IT at her public library in Massachusetts, and she installed HTTPS everywhere, the FF plugin on all of the public computers, which is the sort of thing that, again, you know, maybe in a smaller library where the IT people want to take that that action, that's something easy to do. But at BPL, the way that our internet filter works, because we do deploy an internet filter on the public computers, and this is something many libraries do, often reluctantly, because some amount of federal funding is tied in with installing this type of filtering. But so the filtering that we use, the way the system works now, that is that it does that HTTPS traffic doesn't go through the filter. And so if all of you make your websites use just HTTPS, then it's not being filtered, which, you know, is probably not a bad thing for all your sites. But this is something, like, we can't, you know, if we were to put an HTTPS everywhere on our computers, then our filter, you know, it would negate the use of our filter. So this is one of these kind of frustrating structural things where we want to tell people, like, you know, all right, here's the mic.
But that might not be a bad thing, right? I mean, it's kind of interesting and exciting. I mean, to underscore the point of the power of regulation, so there are a lot of regulatory debates that it would be really lovely for us to examine what are the workarounds that simultaneously get us better privacy and perhaps a greater degree of free expression, but also to consider these other kind of sideways or, you know, less obvious than, like, reforming the Patriot Act or, you know, these big, let's establish baseline consumer privacy in the United States. I feel like there are a number of regulations, particularly with respect to providing universal access to broadband to the libraries, that would lend themselves to some really creative intervention.
Just have a small anecdote to add to that. I was doing some research with high school students at one point and discovered that in one school they were using HTTPS specifically to get around their school filter because none of the HTTPS sites were blocked. So, like, there's a history of this, and there's a cultural practice of this. So I just thought I'd put it for that in there.
Hey. So I learned a couple of things tonight. One of those is that libraries are very trusted institutions. And unfortunately, unfortunately, I also learned that despite a lot of vibrant and passionate energy towards carrying that reputation on and maintaining it in an even more difficult world to do that, that at this point, perhaps that's a questionable assumption, in that, you know, despite the best efforts, you're leaking data all over the place, and there's IT departments and federal funding, all of these things that get in the way of this passionate and important value. And so I guess my question is, what do you do in the meantime? What are the efforts done towards balancing the fact that maybe you're a trusted entity that doesn't currently yet deserve the trust, and, you know, warning people, for example, you are being watched. We know that Amazon can tell when you search for what to expect when you're expecting. We advise you not to do so. I believe there was an anecdote about a young person who was looking for an interlibrary loan about their, that presumably might have related to their sexual identity. And, you know, I guess my question is, you know, what, how do you balance that interest of letting the person know that maybe something might leak about that, and that could be very bad for them? So I guess really anybody who might have any insight, I am really very curious.
It's getting real in here.
I guess, like, so speaking from an academic library perspective, I think basically I try to be as honest with people about that dilemma as I can. And we do a lot of teaching, you know, like we are asked to do these silly sessions where you come and be in a classroom with me for 50 minutes and then you know how to like do research, get a dissertation. And I use those opportunities to like bring up privacy issues when I can, when it makes sense. But there's so much to go into and there are so many like little tiny like nooks and crannies that it's difficult to do much in that like sliver of time that I have with people. But I will say also that more and more our students come like knowing about these sorts of things and will ask really informed questions about like what's happening and how searches work and you know, like the, yeah.
So I don't work in a library, so I can't say specifically what's going to happen in the meantime. I think it's a really important question because I do think there's now this realization that we need to focus on this, both from within libraries and then from outside of libraries in terms of people who want to fund libraries to do this and for us to be thinking about this. So I'm sort of optimistic for the future, but I totally get your question, which is like right now, today, what are libraries doing to let people know they're not ready? And I would say there are probably, there's even work before that, which is to convince libraries that they're not ready.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So I think that's partially what we're trying to do.
And I think, you know, a lot, I'm trying to think of the category of actual question I get from people related to private, like the biggest category of question. And it generally has to do with the public desktop computers. Like if I, you know, I downloaded something from my resume from my email and then I made some changes and I saved it temporarily to the library computer and then I emailed it back to myself. Like can the next person who uses this computer see my resume or, you know, can they know what websites I went to? And so that at least with almost 100% confidence I can say, you know, as soon as you log out, all of that information is wiped, you know, the browser history is gone, the temporary folder on the computer is purged. And then every so often, because some of our computers in the division where I work are Macs and they behave a little wonkily sometimes with our reservation software, and it has happened that like the temporary folder hasn't purged, and so when we see that, you know, we take the computer out of commission immediately and call IT department. So in that biggest category, I do have good answers, and you know the library is taking that seriously. You know, when people connect to the public Wi-Fi, they have to go through this. They have to launch the browser so that they get the screen that basically says, you know, you're not going to do anything illegal, and it says this is an unsecured network. And you know, everybody just kind of zeroes in on the agree and continue button. But you know, that is there. And you know, as with so much of our offline life as the online, you know, that it's all about calculated risk. You know, there are benefits to being on Facebook, there are risks to being on Facebook. And yeah, so we do try to incorporate that into our classes and one-on-one. And, you know, I will admit sometimes we do rush through the context in favor of getting to the accomplishment that the person wants to do. But it's definitely a good thing to keep in mind.
So after listening to Eric, I have a new idea, which is that, and maybe you're actually already doing this, where, you know, it'd be really interesting to do an assessment of, you know, even wider assessment of libraries and kind of like, I don't know, maybe the top 20 public libraries in the United States, they have HTTPS protocol. What kinds of terms of services are they offering?
There's study needed there.
What is their relationship with different kinds of vendors? That kind of research, I think, can be quite telling. The other thing that I'd like to see, and this is just a hunch, but I don't know, maybe it's true. If you compare, so I have this impression, partly because I'm like in love with libraries, I have a long history of being in love with libraries. And so I have this impression that like the value set is actually very strong, like so strong that it can be a motivating factor towards institutional change. So one of the things that I'd be interested to see is how libraries, now that the question is on the table, right, how libraries are doing with, by comparison to like public schools or hospitals, right? Like where we have seen some very, very difficult questions arise about how do we incorporate these new technologies using often third-party vendors or non-Indigenous services and software and infrastructure, and how to cope with that, right? So I'd like to see a comparison across those different contexts. Because I still, the library has been around for a really long time, and I do share Bonnie's optimism that things can be done differently. I do really think that the value set is so strong that it can be a motivating factor.
Thank you. So I guess I have two questions. They're not exactly related. But given your references to the Library of Freedom Project, have any of you actually done any work with them? And are you looking towards doing work with them? And the second thing is, given the filters that you mentioned on LinkedIn, is there a way you see forward that will convince the IT department to either remove the filters or even... Is it possible that the funding that we think requires it is actually just a mystery, a misinterpretation of the actual contract? And
no.
Is
what's the answer? What are you answering to?
Oh, sorry.
The
E-rate funding, if that's a misinterpretation of what it
is there a way you could see potentially, I suppose, given this filtering, providing Tor or something like it within the actual computer as part of the base image of sorts?
So I wish that Nick Merrill were here, because I feel like he could answer that question much more eloquently than me, but from what I understand, part of the work of the Kellogg's Institute is working with a set of librarians, been affiliated with the library community for some time now, and one of the interesting things that I've heard him talk about is the way in which Kellogg's could potentially be kind of like start to bundle things for libraries. And maybe I'm misrepresenting it, but I think what he was talking about was bundling both like the hardware and the software to make it evident to libraries that they actually have a choice. Now, that's not a perfect solution, but it's an interesting one, and I think also an interesting one with respect to how if you were to convince not just libraries in Connecticut that they could do this. But a wider network, we might just see some momentum. It's difficult to be the first mover, though, for a variety of reasons.
Just about Allison and also April Glazer from Electronic Freedom Frontier and the Library Freedom Project. Yeah, their project has a lot to do with public education as well as in the library world. And so, for example, this particular grant that we're working on now is just about the professional development. And by the way, speaking of contradictions, it is specifically the Laura Bush
grant through IMLS.
For the 21st century library.
The 21st century library. But yeah, I think we all know Allison, and she is putting together a 2-day conference that follows the big American Library Association annual conference, which is in San Francisco this year. So I'm going to be there. I think other people will be there. So yeah, there's definitely, you know, if not straight up collaboration per se, but there's connections, and yeah, and then I don't know. I think. With Tor, I think that is something that Allison, when she was still at that Watertown Public Library, she was thinking of doing. I'm not sure if she did it. I mean, again, with like when I think about what I, you know, what I see in my library and what, you know, a conversation that I've had with our IT staff, it would be a really hard sell because, like I said, like people, you know, don't always do nice stuff on there is also. I mean, this is getting into the bigger questions of protection and what we can think about of a political dissident who's using a public computer in the library to, you know, pen texts and to communicate, and we would want to support the privacy of that person. And then you think of, you know, a person who's making assassination attempts against public figures and who is, you know, abusing somebody through and using a public computer to do that. You know, when there is a question of protecting, you know, the safety of the community, and when the library is a node on sort of the information chain, you know, what are the library's responsibilities? And, you know, American Library Association guidelines emphasize privacy, but, you know, they also state, which is true, that the, you know, library is subject to all of the state and federal laws that govern it and must give up information if subpoenaed. So I think, so just thinking, like, that would be a hard battle to fight to really anonymize the traffic.
I would just say also that the Library Freedom Project is doing these workshops and actually talking about through tools with librarians, which has been really wonderful because I think now more than ever before people are thinking about putting Tor on machines, maybe not in public libraries with filtering, but I mean, I have colleagues who instantly wanted to go back to the lab and start looking into that in ways that I think just me saying it as a colleague would not have gotten the traction that Allison has been. Oh, and the conference is Digital Rights in Libraries. It's on June 29th and 30th. It is free. It's in San Francisco. You can Google it or use DuckDuckGo and find out.
Just really quickly, so I think one thing that continues to kind of gnaw at me as we're talking about like using these tools like Tor is the question of usability and accessibility, and I know that Gus is in the room here, Gus Andrews, and other folks have been thinking about usability, and I do actually think that that is part of the equation as libraries are considering, like, wait a second, how are we going to actually, like, it's difficult, right? And that, I think, I would put the responsibility, yes, the library community can filter feedback to Tor developers and other open source security software developers, but I think that question around usability is one that hopefully is active. And I don't know why I keep pointing to this side of the room.
For reasons.
It's being captured on videotape. Or video something.
Okay.
So maybe we'll have time for one more question.
Maybe
in the back, yeah?
Yeah, just a quick tactical thing, I can pick up, sorry. You guys talked about the gateway role you guys have for a distribution channel, really, role for some of these back-end databases and information services and whatnot. And are they sharing in the what they're doing in terms of mining the queries that are coming basically through your channel? Are they sharing that data back? Has there been any of that that goes on? Is that that they're any interest in getting some of that in order to get some leverage with them? Or
yeah, I think that's vendor to vendor. So I think there's been some vendors do share some information back. What I actually, the direction I thought you were going, which is a bit different, is do we know how they use it, or if they packaged it up and actually let third parties use it, which actually, I recently read an article that I don't know the citation of, but there's just a conversation about how an analysis of licenses that academic libraries have signed with vendors, that a very small percentage, but there was a percentage that specifically said that they have the right to give that data to third-party vendors. So I think that should be kind of one of the basic principles of like, that we don't sign licenses that have that, or that we're clear as to what that means and that kind of thing. But I would say it's really case by case. I don't know if you guys know of any specific examples where a vendor has kind of packaged that up and given that back to the library, but I think that does happen.
Which was the small percentage, that they do grant third-party access or they don't grant third-party access?
Well, that they're explicit in the license that they do.
And what's the percentage of ones where they explicitly say in the license that they must not?
I think in this particular study where they were looking at 29 licenses across different vendors that academic libraries use, I don't think any of them explicitly said they would not. I think it was either explicitly we will, or there was no mention of that. And I think that's a new term in licenses for libraries. It's like a brand new term. Like 5 or 10 years ago, I can't imagine that would be a term in a license between a library and a vendor.
But as a library, you can often see in some cases I could go log in and see like here's some search terms or if there's like a particular item that's being downloaded. So there's lots of data that's being
Yeah.
Want a final comment, Eric?
To comment on that, I looked at 20 of the top academic journals and found that 17 of them enabled tracking by advertising networks on their websites. So basically these advertising networks saw everything that every user clicked on.
One more.
I just to bounce really quickly off of you mentioned public schools, and I was wondering, like, I work for a human rights organization, and a lot of our MND protection and models for like those kinds of legal structures come from protection minors. I was wondering if anyone had heard of children's librarians or university librarians who work with minors who had special legal protections that we could model off of for adults.
So I'll just answer quickly that it's not specifically related to libraries, but COSIN and the Data Quality Campaign recently released the student privacy principles, which are 10 principles. And they've got a bunch of organizations that have signed on to it, including the School Library Association. They're pretty high level, and so some of the complaints I've heard is like all these big organizations have signed on to it at a high level, but what does that actually mean on the ground for real parents and students? But you might want to check those out because they're specifically around student data.
It seems like all that data tracking should be totally legal for minors.
Yeah.
That is, of course, also why we have those filters as well.
For the children.
Yes. It's for somebody for children.
Guess what it is?
It's 25. Okay. So I think we need to clear the space by 9, and I wanted everyone to have a chance to chat with each other, meet each other for a minute. I would just say let's continue this conversation. All of the librarians that are here, come to the next Techno-Activism Third Monday. It happens every month. Clearly, you can just hijack it at any time and talk about what you want to talk about. So if you have a topic, let me know, and let's keep the conversation going. Hold us accountable, and hopefully we can follow up with better news soon.